Hey there, Tribble Nation. What's up? This is Len, a.k.a. The Bat Tribble, and I am joined in the beautiful studios of WHYY by...
What's up, what's up? It's Kennedy, also known as that Mikey chick, also known as Storm Tribble.
And as part of our month-long celebration of everything Afrofuturistic and in celebration of the adorned author Octavia Butler, we are continuing with Octavia City today, speaking with Adrian Marie Brown, editor of Octavia's Brood. Hello, Adrian.
Hi, it's great to be here with the Tribbles. I'm like trying to pick out my Tribble name right now.
Oh, yeah.
You have to come up with one before it's all said and done.
Definitely. Before it's all said and done, you will have to pick one. You are actually here in Philadelphia. You've got like a couple of events going on, but in support of Octavia's Brood, which is a collection, if you will, of sci-fi stories, but they definitely have a theme of social justice. Where you pick that from?
So I'm here. I'm working with my co-editor, Walida E. Marisha, who actually has some Philly roots. Y'all may know her.
Thank you for saying her name, because I didn't want to butcher it.
Okay.
So I'm just telling you right now, Walida, I knew that you were also a co-editor, but I didn't want to butcher your name. So go ahead. Continue about Walida. Now
so,
I know it.
Walida E. Marisha. I'm trying to make sure everyone knows her name. And she and I got together a few years ago because we were both separately obsessing over this idea that science fiction was a place to explore social justice concepts and ideology, and that all organizing is science fiction, that
really?
Everyone who is actually working to bend the future and change the world is engaged in a science fictional activity. And if we sort of see ourselves that way as shapeshifters, changers of the future, which I think Octavia gave us orders to see ourselves that way, our purpose is to shape change and to be shaped by change, right? If we see ourselves that way and take on that responsibility, then the next piece is figuring out, well, what is our particular work within that? Well, we're writers and we're organizers. And so this project came out of both of us feeling passionate about that and looking around at the landscape and seeing so many exciting organizers who we wanted to know, you know, they're out there at the forefront of thinking about these changes. What's the horizon that they see? What do they think is possible? Not utopian, not dystopian. We call the work visionary fiction, which means it's hard, it's realistic, it's hopeful. It looks at bottom-up change. It centers marginalized communities. It disrupts the traditional hero narrative. So change is something that is collective. So we really wanted to play with getting people who were out at that front line to tell us the horizon they saw, to write us stories. And it was a massive experiment. It was really a massive experiment. A lot of the people were very skeptical, and rightly so. You know, they're like, I don't write fiction. And I keep telling people, the main confession we got from people was like, I've never even seen Star Wars, you know. And I was like, okay. And, you know, I keep saying, we just watch Star Wars and then... You have seen it. But also, it's like, what we're looking for is something other than that. And what we receive back from people is something that really, I think, reshapes the genre. Walida's been saying genrecide. Like, it kind of smashes.
Like, killed it.
It smashes the genre, and it takes things to another level, because it's sci-fi, it's magical realism, fantasy, myth, horror. It's all in there. And then we go beyond that.
Wow. Y'all went far.
Game changing.
Yes.
I can dig it, though. I dig the whole idea of like change as being science fiction, because just by your definition, that is so very true. You know what I mean? Science fiction, just to be able to see that future and then try to write it. Yeah. But I can also understand people's apprehension about, I didn't write fiction, or I don't know sci-fi, you know.
Exactly.
It's the same thing. It's kind of the same pushback we get when people, we talk to them about Black Tribbles and say, well, I'm not a geek. Yes, you are.
We see the geek in you, boo. I mean, my thing is, I'm just like, we really, you know, so part of my work for the past about 18 years or so has been doing social justice facilitation.
Really?
So I work with groups who are trying to come up with visions or mediate or process grievance, but a lot of groups will ask me to help them do a strategic plan or help them do something that looks at the future. And so over and over again, I'm sitting with these groups, I'm like, all you're doing is thinking about the future. You have really clear ideas about it. However, we've never seen the things you're trying to bring into existence. So we sit and have very intense conversations about what transformative justice needs to look like. And we get disappointed with ourselves because we don't see it happening every day right now, you know, in our movements. But it's also like, we're so young in this work. We have so far to go. And how do we understand that we're being visionary just by seeing it and by attempting to mold ourselves into the kind of people who could practice transformative justice, or the kind of society that could really honestly say there's no rape, there's no hunger, there's no, like, an understanding that it's not external changes. Mm-hmm. It's really, there's so much that's internal changes. Yeah. Like, what kind of people do we have to become? I think that's geek work. I think that's nerd work. Yeah. I think that's, we're the ones who are like looking forward and thinking about that. So, you know, Waleed and I were like, it's our responsibility. We have to claim this space. We're doing it. We might as well claim it and say, and she and I were both like, we have to put ourselves in the book. You know, we have to take the same step we're asking everyone else to take, which means that for almost everyone in the book, our first major piece of sci-fi that's being read by the public is being read in this collection that is blowing up and, you know, like selling out way beyond anyone's expectations. And so it's just like all of a sudden your name is out there as a sci-fi writer. And I'm like, good. I want to have a lot of people think that this is something that's doable. This is an accessible art form and an accessible liberation tool.
I was going to say, a lot of the themes that you were just discussing as far as changing a frame of reference, as far as how you think things, how you attack problems, how you rectify problems, and all of that is very Roddenberryan. Do you know what I mean? That whole no hunger, no violence, no need for an economy, because, you know, your drive in life is not the almighty dollar. It's how do I preserve this way of life? How do I set up a new one for future generations? How do I continue to explore? So I'm sure that parallels is pretty important.
Are we claiming a new phrase now? I've heard like Darwinian, so now there's Roddenberryan.
I know. I was like, I'm loving that Roddenberryan.
You've
That's
never
great.
Heard that before?
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, Roddenberryanism.
I love it. Well, and I think that, you know, like, I grew up watching Star Trek.
Yay.
My father was a Trekkie and is a Trekkie still. And I think that Gene Roddenberry did maybe the best work that a white man could do in terms of pleasing my my sci-fi visionary needs, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm very impressed with what Star Trek was putting forward at the time it was putting it forward. And I think there's something different that happens, and this is why Octavia Butler is my patron saint, goddess, prophet, mm-hmm. because there's something different that comes out when a black woman who is marginalized in a society right. is writing about the future. There's
yeah.
just some places that she can access that really make me feel safe and challenged. And I want, you know, like, I'm just like, I want more of us. She didn't want to be alone. She said that. She's like, I don't want to be the only one doing this.
Right.
And so part of the concept of the brood is to be like, it's an invitation, and it's giving a lot more of us permission to say, like, hell yeah, Star Trek was incredible. William Gibson is amazing. There's all these brilliant, brilliant, brilliant white sci-fi writers. And there's also a lot that are really not brilliant, not pushing the edge, not doing anything exciting.
Right.
And that's already out there. We might as well be putting ourselves out there, putting ourselves into that future as well.
Agreed. Agreed. Plus, it almost, there's something about the way of reimagining not only a future scape, but also a social consciousness state that is inherent from, in my opinion, a black woman's perspective anyway. Do you know what I mean? Because of the fact that we've been marginalized for so many reasons over such an extended period of time, to have that opportunity to, you know, put your own input on what you can perceive the future to be, it's not as much as a jarring thing to conceptualize. You know what I mean? That's not so far-fetched.
Yeah.
Like that you, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. And that's because a lot of, you know, what's been established through popularized science fiction incorporates us in some way, shape, or form, maybe in larger roles, maybe in smaller roles. But, you know, Serenity, the whole Firefly thing is one of them, with Gina Torres and her contribution to that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Trek through Uhura and Guinan. Guinan's character is so butlerish. Like,
yes.
Come on. Like, how can you not see that
Trek
parallel? And even in other iterations of Trek, as far as Alfred Woodard's character
in
First Contact.
First Contact.
You know, she was a complete outside perspective, looking in different time, different, you know, background. And here's Jean-Luc and all them according to their way. And she's like, dude.
And how about, reaching back, and that Alfred Woodard actually, you know, voiced an adaptation of Kindred.
Right. So it just kind of falls in. The genre kind of creates itself in a way.
Yeah, and, you know, for Waleed and I as two black women, I think there was something really important for us about thinking of what is the lineage of our work? What is the ancestral lineage of our work? And we could trace it back. So we were like, okay, obviously Octavia, obviously there's Audre Lorde in there, obviously mm-hmm. there's Tony Cade Bambara and Making the Revolutionary Irresistible. And obviously, you know, we can go back and grab these people. But then before that, there were the black women whose names cannot be known.
Right.
And most of them, the creation that they were doing was mothering mm-hmm. and continuing to create life against all the odds, continuing to create life in extremely violent conditions. And we look at like our moment right now and the amount of suffering, the amount of trauma that we hold, and it does seem so impossible that change is going to happen. But then if you call all the way back in that lineage, there's someone in the past who did this, you know, there's someone who thought like, I don't know for sure, but I feel something that compels me to continue creating forward into the void, and I'm going to do that. And, you know, so it's just like call on someone behind you to start to articulate that forward path. And I love the writing that's coming out from black women right now. I think Nalo Hopkinson, Tananarive Due, Nnedi Okorafor, N.K. Jemisin.
Yeah.
You know, there's mm-hmm. some folks out there that I'm like, this is some of the best writing, and we're doing it. It's our right. folks, you know. And then I want to also throw in there people who would not have seen this as a place to explore, right? So
right.
I'm excited to then uplift our writers of Alexis Pauline Gums and Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samra Sinha and Autumn Brown and myself and Walida and others into that mix and say, yeah, we're all cooking this.
You said that you reached out to some people who had never written fiction or science fiction before. I know one of the writers in the book is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yes.
How did you make that connection, and how did that go?
Yeah, over? So we're blessed that Walida's main work, like one of the main things that she's done in her life, is support of political prisoners, going in, visiting with political prisoners, listening to their words, getting their ideas and other things coming out of that space and organizing on their behalf. So she had relationship there. And when we were originally thinking about the idea for this book, it was like, wouldn't it be so amazing? And she's like, I know that Mumia is a geek. Like, I know this for sure. And I think that he could have some really great content to offer. And so she was the one who made that connection. And, you know, there were options, right? Like, it was like, do we want to get a piece of fiction? Do we want an essay? Like, what would be the best right. option? And what we ended up getting from him is, we play at every single place we go. We have an audio recording of him sharing his piece, and it's incredible. And it's about Star Wars and imperialism, American imperialism. Mm. And it's basically talks about why did America suck this up? Like, why did we take Star Wars and just get so completely obsessed with it, and how it speaks to our desire to see ourselves as the ragtag rebels all the time. But it also really articulates that the rebels are not that many steps away from empire. There's
yes,
this
true.
Deep, intimate connection. And, you know, and he says, I am your father, Luke. And it's just like a mind-blowing experience to hear Mumia say that. And our hope, our vision, what we want to manifest is that he is able to get well, that his family is able to access him, that he stops being so isolated, and that he's able to actually come back and record the entire audiobook. That is our future that we are manifesting the possibilities for. So we want to ask everyone to throw some vision on that and make it happen.
That's dope. That's
yeah.
Really dope. Octavia's Brood, which is available everywhere, because I've seen it everywhere,
yeah.
With the gorgeous cover. Is that John Jennings? Yeah.
Yeah, John Jennings is incredible. Isn't he the boo?
That's
like, I feel like he's
boo.
Officially the boo.
Like, you're the boo, John.
He's the boo. He's everyone's boo. He's everyone's beloved. I mean, he's actually, it's amazing, because he's actually this really fly brother, doing great organizing,
yeah.
really uplifting so many other artists and mm-hmm. so many other sci-fi creators, mm-hmm. and then on top of that, somehow prolifically turning out this gorgeous work. He did our cover. He just did Ferguson is the Future is a major
yeah.
event that we're doing in Princeton in the fall, September 14th, I believe, and he just produced the flyer for that, which is absolutely stunning. So he came to us. He was just like, I want to do this for y'all. And it was just like, you know, we fainted and then we got back up on and then we were like, oh my gosh. And the thing that I want to tell people, you may not know this, but he created a glyph system. So each story in the book has a glyph that goes with it. And those are incorporated into the cover.
I wondered about that, looking at specifically all of the images on the cover. And I wonder whether or not that played a part. I'm glad you point that out, because I wanted to know, okay, what story has to do with the mouse? Because there's a mouse on there.
There's a story called Little Brown Mouse. And it's Tunde Olaniran. Oh, he's going to kill me. Olaniran. He's an incredible artist in his own right. And again, someone who had not written sci-fi, but who thinks sci-fi does sci-fi in every aspect of his art and his life, work, right. Like it's his life. And he wrote this story for us, which is about the sort of thin line between mental health and parallel universe. Mm. And like, how do you know which is which when you're in that space?
That is a it's shaky, awesome. Slippery.
I'm always in the other universe. Like, wait, am I crazy right now? Right. What's happening?
Right. Did I just transcend something conventional or am I officially losing my stuff?
Exactly. And is it so bad to lose your stuff in this world? I don't think so. That's true. Yeah. That's cool. The little brown mouse.
That's comforting.
Exactly.
It's definitely comforting.
Yeah,
now,
I think you'll like it.
Next time I skip the groove, I won't feel as bad getting the train back on track.
You're like, oh, it's just me.
Crossing boundaries.
Yeah, Toon Day is fantastic. John Jennings is fantastic. Cherie Renee Thomas, who was the editor of the Dark Matter collections, she came on as our advisor for the project. Up until that point, I think Waleed and I were like, you know, we were pretty confident. We're like, we're doing this project. We can do this, you know. We're nerds. We know what's a good story. Mm-hmm. But there was something that happened. We asked Cherie to read everything. And when she came back and was like, this is great. You have, like, really quality stories. These will stand the test of time. Then I think both of our shoulders dropped a little. We were like, okay, this isn't just a radical vanity project or something,
right?
It really started to feel like, okay. And I think so far we've been getting nonstop great feedback from people. I think people really see what we were trying to do and really see that these writers took these concepts out of their dreams and placed them on paper. And so there's so much bravery in the act of getting this book out there. We're loving it.
I think another fun aspect of this that is a little disturbing but good to see is that this keeps the name of Octavia Butler alive. I have reached out for Octavia City, reached out to some people about being part of it, you know, people that I even thought or knew like science fiction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them weren't aware of Octavia Butler, you know? It's incredible as renowned as she is, how still unknown she is, you know, after this time.
It's been incredible for us because first of all, part of the success of our book is the people who do know her, you know, it's like you kind of know her and you're like,
that's my total obsession.
Right. And so we're getting a huge feedback from that, but it is for us a way to uplift her name and then continue uplifting others' names. And I want to say last year we did an event in Seattle at a place called EMP, and there's a poet organizer there named Krista Bell, and she got up and she did this piece, and it was a whole gorgeous poem. But one of the things she said was she told this sort of parable about our ancestors being in this other world and how those who are remembered and their names are remembered and called out, they are happy, they're in the light, they live abundant lives in the afterworld, and it's just, it really is a form of utopia or form of heaven. It's good for them.
Yeah.
And those who are forgotten, whose names are not spoken, they're in the corners, in the shadows, alone, scared and forgotten and unfed and hungry and, you know,
wow.
It's really suffering, right? And there was something about that was so, that really jarred me, you know, because we know how many folks we don't know the names of. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about this recent process of us learning to say the names of our those who are losing right now. You know, we're all like, Walter Scott is our name now that we're saying. And what does it mean for us all to be calling out his name and as he transitions, being like, we love you. This was wrong. What happened to you? And then tying that back into someone like Octavia, who has offered us so much vision and so much real prophecy for the future. And what does it mean to call her out and say, we are not forgetting you. We want to shine a lot of light on you and let you know that you're loved. And so we have Octavia's Brood. I've also done a collection of reflections on Earthseed, which is just 35 reflections on the 35 verses of Earthseed. Like, all of it is just, like, keep reading her. Read her over and over again. Like, let's all be able to reference her work easily and be able to quote her easily. Mm-hmm. She's earned that.
When were you first introduced to Octavia Butler?
I was, I think, late teens. And, you know, when I first read her work, I was like, this is great. I love it. But I didn't understand what a huge impact it was going to have on me right away. Mm-hmm. I got to see her speak in college. And, you know, it just, I laugh because I was all like, oh my gosh. And she's like, hello. You know, it's just like, oh, you're Octavia. And I think that impacted me a lot. because she didn't fit the paradigm that I'd been given for people who were going to blow my mind. And she was so blowing my mind, you know, right. She was so powerful. And I love, and I uplift this all the time for the nerds and the geeks out there, I love that she spent the bulk of her life like reading and taking in and processing the world and feeling it so deeply. But she wasn't out giving speeches. She wasn't out giving talks. She wasn't at the, you know, rallying folks together. She was sitting alone. She was processing and writing.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's so many of us who are called to do that, to crawl into the nook and create. And that's not always seen as a revolutionary act, or that's not always seen as a communal act. But what she was doing was so vulnerable. And ultimately, what she wrote about over and over again was community and interdependence and the need to connect. And I think a lot of that came out of her longing for others and for you know, it's like knowing that she's alone and upset. And, you know, I don't think she lacked relationships. I think she had those. But I also think she longed for better from humanity, better connection in humanity.
Yeah.
You know,
I read an essay that she wrote in Essence back in, I think, 2000. Mm-hmm. And it was about how she had connected with a dog, a pet dog, when she was young. And then going forward to her watching how people were reacting to chimpanzees caged. And she was just fixated on the eyes and seeing the anger and sadness in the chimpanzees. And her just wanting, like, wishing she like could have a key to like open up the cage, like, yeah, let's see y'all laugh at them chimpanzee
laugh
this
at
way
them now,
right, you know. It was really, really dope.
And I was moved. I mean, I'm always moved by how much she spoke of anger as a major like spark for how she did her work.
Force, right.
Because I feel like that's something we really need to cultivate. Is right now it's like we get angry and we get angry, you know, and it's just like we act from our anger. We rise up and away from our anger, and we're not left with much on the other side of that, right? And I think we're still learning, how do we take this anger and generate with it, use it to generate community, generate future.
Use it as a fuel as opposed to a
hammer. Exactly. And I think
that's,
you know, she did a great job of that, of like, what is the world we would generate from this anger that we're feeling? What do we want to make possible? Because this is impossible. It is impossible to survive in these conditions. And right now, I think that's our question. Like, I think that's the question for Black people particularly. What world are we going to generate in which what's currently happening is impossible?
We had a question. I want to throw this on you.
Okay.
We were talking about, you know, why Octavia Butler's work hasn't been adapted more out there.
Ooh, eye roll.
Side eye. You got the full side eye from me? Like, I know.
Dude, honey.
Yeah, like, I have heard that recently, I think Ava DuVernay is looking to work on one of her pieces. I think Kindred. Yes.
But she said she'd like to. So it's making the connections then with all the... Yeah.
That's what she's got to do first.
Exactly.
You know? And we had theories as to why we thought maybe her work hadn't been adapted right now. What do you think?
I mean, I think racism is a good first reason. You know, I think that people not being able to see or be excited about a Black female protagonist changing the world and having the next vision for things,
mm-hmm,
is one of the reasons why it hasn't been adapted at the large scale, right?
Right.
While you have stories, you know, Matt Damon saving the world over and over again or whatever, and it's like, but a lot of it even, I think, is inspired by stories that Octavia wrote. You know, I see a lot of parallels that don't seem real parallel to me. The other reason I would say is I don't think we've been ready. Like, so some of her stories, like Lilith's Brood, like The Pattern Master, I don't think we've had everything we needed in place to be able to tell the story well. And I'm not sure if we're even there yet. And by everything in place, I mean like the right directors, the right actors, the right producers, the right resources, the right special effects, everything necessary to actually do it at the quality that it deserves to be done. Because for most of us, these worlds live in our heads now. Like,
right,
Lilith's Brood, you know, like, I see that place. I know what the Onkali look like. Mm-hmm. I see the Uloi, like, and I don't want someone to come give me some busted version of that. Like, I really want it to be, do you know what I'm saying? I was like, I want you to do the best movie you could do of this. And I feel like we finally are getting to a place where there are enough Black powerhouses in that Hollywood realm. And then you have folks like Tanana Reeve-Dhu and Stephen Barnes and other folks coming up. You have Ava DuVernay. We have the community now that I think could actually do justice to this. We have Dream Hampton. We have others who I think are passionate, interested, and lined up and ready to do it. So I think, it, you know, it's not that it would have never worked to do it earlier, but I always try to see, like, why is this the right way, right? If this is the way that things are happening, like, what makes it the right way? And so that's the best I can get to. It's like, we must have been not quite ready, and I hope that we are ready now. I think Kindred would be a great place to begin.
I think it's the most accessible.
Exactly. I think it's super accessible. You know, parables make so much sense, and it's so terrifying.
Yeah.
So apparently in the Huntington Library with her papers, there's all of these drafts of the third parables
book, right?
And I have a lot of curiosity about getting as much as we can of that and seeing what a parables television series or episodic thing would look like. And doing it on Netflix.
Netflix will be the place to do it.
I'm like, oh, we didn't even have Netflix, you know, when we first started thinking about some of this stuff, right? We didn't have it in that way. Like, but I'm like, now that I've done the House of Cards things a couple times, I'm like, that's how I want to do parables. Like, I want to do the parable of the sower in one, like, 13 episode, you know, and just get it in my system.
That's how I feel about Fledgling.
Yes, girl.
I feel like Fledgling is like a miniseries, like an HBO or Netflix or Amazon Prime kind of thing. Like, I think that's a really cool way to do it. Because Fledgling doesn't require a lot in the way of special effects. It's more about the location and the type of people you can cast in those roles.
Exactly.
And if it's not Quvan Janay Ellis, I'll be really upset.
I mean, I want Quvan Janay for the parables, but I feel you.
Really?
No, I feel you.
See, I never read the parables. I've only
heard,
I know.
Oh my God!
Yeah, you slacking, girl.
How many of hold on, pause. Okay. How many have you read, Len?
How many of what?
Of Octavia's books have you read?
If you could cast.
Have you read everything? I'll tell you, my experience that I'm having right now with y'all is not disappointment, which it may look like on my face. It's actual jealousy. Right, it's jealousy because
for me,
again for
the first
time. Every time I know that someone's about to get to experience her work for the first time, which I know you're going to read everything, it's so exciting to me because she will blow your mind out. And have you guys read the Pattern Master series?
Possibly. Listen, I've read Lilith's Brood,
okay,
which was my gateway book, and I was instantly first chapter like,
exactly.
You know. Then I read Wild Seed.
Yes. So that's the first of the Pattern Master.
Okay,
series.
So then yes, I didn't know because a lot of her collections have been re-released under different names because Lilith's Brood was Xenogenesis initially, wasn't it?
Which I like better as a name.
I like them both either way because as long as it's still the same thing, you can call it whatever you want, just as long as it's still there.
That's fantastic. Wild Seed is actually now the book that I encourage people to start with. For a long time, I said start with Parable, the Sower, and the Talents.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Wild Seed is one of the greatest love stories of all time and one of the greatest love stories that she's written. It's fundamental.
I had difficulty accepting that.
Well, did you keep reading? Did you remind
my mind? I've
only read
the first one. No.
Okay, well, let's talk after you. Brad.
Okay, fine. Fledgling.
Oh, yes.
And I've heard Fledgling really gripped me again because of the whole pleasure principle, whole breaking down the established gender roles and partner roles and family structure or whatever.
Yeah.
You also, for you vampire heads, you get your vampire kick too.
Yes,
but then the social justice aspect of, I forget the character's name, but the protagonist in this world. Thank you. Shuri, something like that.
Exactly.
You know, she is a unique amongst uniqueness in this whole other world that we're still discovering as she is, because her whole amnesia thing, but
and there's this ageism component of it, right? Because she
appears
to be a young person,
right?
She's
and still
lovers all across the map of age, which is very complex for
and
us.
Then and still she's also not young by our standards, certainly, but young by her people's standards.
Exactly.
So she's experiencing ageism from them, too. Yeah. They're kind of like, little girl, please, if you don't sit down somewhere. And she's like,
Esteban Kelly, who's this amazing organizer, facilitator, had me answer a question where he said pair sci-fi and non-sci-fi things. And Octavia's obsession with pleasure and the way it showed up in so many of her books as the unifying principle, the thing that would bring people together across difference, that showed up. So I said Lilith's Brood and The Uses of the Erotic by Audre Lorde, which if you haven't read that, I think everyone who's reading Octavia needs to, you can Google Uses of the Erotic by Audre Lorde, and there's a video that you can hear her voice, hear her read it. And it just talks about this, how pleasure advances us as humans, at least as far as suffering, at least as far as struggling in response to that, if not more so.
Right.
And once you've experienced pleasure, you don't want to return to struggle. And how do we actually create that as a reality for all human beings? And I think Octavia's work offers that over and over again. It's these, you know, polyamorous, multi-structural relationships. How mm-hmm. do we do that and then use that as a way to create change?
Right.
Octavia's Brood is available everywhere, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Amazon, everywhere online, and probably
AK Press's website.
AK Press website,
yeah.
Yes, most definitely.
If you come to octaviasbrood.com, you can see all the places for buying.
Dope.
Yeah.
We've got to get you out of here, but
all
not
right.
before you join the Tribble Nation.
Oh,
to
yes.
do that, you have to tell us what will be your Tribble designation.
I think that my Tribble designation is Cosmic Love Tribble.
Oh, I like that
wow,
one.
Wow, I like that one.
You like
that's
it?
That's I'm easy, like Sunday like, morning.
Yeah, I'm part of this whole like bold black love movement, and Sister Cosmic Love is my name. And I was like, I think that's my Tribble name, too. I'm Cosmic
Love, Love Tribble.
Yeah.
Man.
It's beautiful already.
All right.
It's huggable.
I feel so, I know it's hug, guys.
Yay!
Oh. Yay.
But it's not official.
Yeah, you're not okay. done yet.
What's official?
Until Kennedy says so. So
okay.
really quick. Go ahead, Kennedy.
So you're going to repeat after me. It's a fairly painless process from here on out. Oh, yes, you can do some saluting
Spock
if you
hands.
Like. Yes. Basically, you're going to repeat after me.
All right.
I'm a Tribble furry. I'm a Tribble true.
I'm a Tribble furry. I'm a Tribble true.
From the way I roll to the way I coo.
From the way I roll to the way I coo.
So shall it be said, so shall it be done.
Adrienne
Marie
Brown
is Cosmic Love Tribble. That's beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Yay.
Hey,
thank you
great.
All.
I still get chills when people take the oath.
It's so sweet.
I know. I mean, first Nichelle Nichols, now Adrienne Marie Brown.
I let out a shout in the Cincinnati airport at the TSA. We're concerned when I heard that podcast. By the way.
Dope. Thank you very much, Adrienne.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
I love y'all.
Coming.